there's been a lot of buzz around what is out in theaters right now. And one of the movies that has come out as controversial has been Sound of Freedom, which highlights human trafficking. Now, I'm going to put this out there right now. I don't want to talk about the controversy. I don't want to talk about the politics of it. I don't want to get into any of that garbage, to be honest, because I'd rather talk about the issue at hand, which is that human trafficking is a problem in the United States, across the globe. It continues to be a real issue. People don't realize that human trafficking is actually alive and well right here in Connecticut as we speak. And one of the things I'm grateful for with this film, whether you liked it or you don't, you're for it or against it, is that we're talking about human trafficking. That's one great takeaway from this. And so I wanted to welcome back to the show a nonprofit organization that we've highlighted several times on the morning show. I got connected about a year ago to PET, Partnership to End Human Trafficking, a nonprofit right here in Connecticut. And joining us today is the president of PET, and that's Elizabeth Klondike Bulbal here on WICC. Elizabeth, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you, Melissa, for giving us a platform and continuing to support our work.
Absolutely. So, Elizabeth, you're the founder. You actually launched PET back in 2016. What compelled you to do that?
You know, it was really just being educated and exposed to the issue. I had done a lot of work internationally, mission work with World Vision, and had seen it firsthand, particularly child trafficking, which was something I really couldn't live with. And then subsequently learned that it was happening in the United States, and it was not only just happening in the United States, it was actually happening right here in Fairfield County, in Greenwich, in Darien, and in Norwalk, Stamford. It's really everywhere. It's in all 50 states. And right in your backyard, it's just very undercover. You know, it's just not in plain sight. But if you look for it, it's there. And it's just something that I couldn't really live with, knowing that in this country, you know, founded on freedom and rights and anti-slavery, that we had modern day slavery going on, was just something I couldn't live with. So I just wanted to do something.
So what is it exactly that Partnership to End Human Trafficking does? I know it's a 501c3 charitable organization here in Connecticut, but what is it, the work that you actually do?
So the work we actually do, we have a three-pronged strategy: educate, embrace, empower. And the first 2 years, when I founded the organization in 2016, like many of your viewers and listeners, I'm sure, didn't really understand that this was happening in this country. And that's, I do appreciate the film exposing the issue, but it doesn't focus necessarily on what's happening in this country, which is devastating, and many people just don't realize it. So we spent the first year and a half really just educating our local community, hosting roundtables, film screenings, et cetera, just to sort of raise awareness, you know, inviting other organizations to speak about the issue. And then in 2020, we actually opened our residence. So what we offer is a holistic 24-month residential therapeutic trauma-informed recovery for survivors. So women that are coming off the streets really just need a place to heal. They need services. They need education. They need health care. They need trauma-informed therapeutic services. So we provide all of that. And we're very individualistic, because no survivor's journey is the same. So we individualize our program towards them and their needs. That's the embrace part of our strategy. And then the empower part of our strategy is, we actually have a business that women will come into. We manufacture and sell PET products, but also home products as well, but products that are made by the women that come into our program. And they work once they've kind of had some of the healing processes that they need, and they've had the time to heal, they're invited to work, because it's an important part of their recovery is that they have economic independence. Because what I believe, and what our team believes, and part of our strategy, is that economic independence is the ultimate goal. And you can bring a survivor, you can walk alongside a woman that's experience this kind of trauma, but unless she has the ability to work and to become economically independent, her recovery will not be sustainable. So that's sort of the three-pronged strategy that we employ.
And again, we have Elizabeth here. She's the president and founder of PET, which is Partnership to End Human Trafficking, a nonprofit organization right here in Connecticut. Elizabeth, give us some perspective for people who may not realize how often is human trafficking happening here in Connecticut?
It's happening every day. You know, there's just been recent issues with the Stanford Public Schools, with children actually being disappearing. It's the problem, Melissa, is that it's growing. You know, this is one of those issues that because of the internet and because of the profitability of the business itself, it's expanding and growing every day. And I would say the internet is probably the biggest facilitator of trafficking at this point because it allows access to people and women and children, you know, in ways that wasn't, you know, women no longer need to go walk on the street and pimps no longer need to solicit directly. They can do it through anonymity and they can do it online. So it's a very dangerous, dangerous business.
How are people getting trafficked? How is this happening? You'll have listeners today who will say, what are you talking about? We live in Fairfield County. We live in Connecticut. This stuff doesn't happen here. But you're saying it's happening every day, Elizabeth. How is that possible?
Well, it's happening. Labor trafficking is also happening. So, you know, I'm sure in the news we've seen, you know, the nail salons and massage parlors that are exposed. The labor trafficking is also happening, and we work with survivors of labor trafficking as well. And the sex trafficking is happening, again, via the internet. So I would say that the crisis in mental health is contributing to this. You know, many people who are preyed upon are suffering from mental health issues, low self-esteem, insecurity, depression. That can also feed into it. Traffickers are very sophisticated in their recruitment process. So it can happen. Many children that are runaways are vulnerable. It's happening with really economic vulnerability and psychological vulnerability are the keys. And traffickers are very wise about identifying that and, you know, exploiting it, really. I mean, that's kind of at the end of the day, that's really what happens.
Talk, if you don't mind, Elizabeth, about also how location is key. You know, Connecticut is smack dab between New York City, Boston, Massachusetts, Hartford. So some very active cities where it's probably easy to traffic people as well, no?
Yes. Well, and the I-95 corridor is sort of where we're kind of focused. And it is a fluid business. You know, women are moved, you know, from location to location, which sort of perpetuates the instability that they feel. So, yes, the I-95 corridor is a very active region, and that's where we've sort of focused. But it's happening Berlin Turnpike, you know, the hotels all up and down. You know, you just pick up a local paper and you'll read about it, you know, happening. Many of the sort of hotels and strip clubs are a main mecca of a lot of this. It's where the business is, you know, handled.
Elizabeth Poldike-Bulbo is here, and Elizabeth is the founder and the president of PET, P-E-H-T, which stands for Partnership to End Human Trafficking. And we're talking about the relevance of human trafficking, not just in Connecticut, but across the country, across the globe, rather. And it comes after there has been a lot of talk about this new film that is out in theaters. I have to confess I have not seen it yet, but it's called Sound of Freedom. And without getting into any of the specifics about the film, without getting into really any of the controversy, none of that, Elizabeth, I would imagine that your nonprofit would be happy that this is being highlighted on an international scale with the release of this movie. I mean, do you believe that we do a good enough job as a society highlighting the issue of human trafficking?
Well, that's a really good question, and I am very grateful to the filmmakers for getting this film out and for it being so well received. You know, honestly, there's been so much dialogue around it, so it's really great. And, you know, there's always just shining a light really just makes such a difference when you have an issue like this that people just really don't want to talk about because it is so uncomfortable. But I don't think we do a good enough job. I think we're just such a highly sexualized society. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's women that are exploited. And I have such an issue with that. And I think we just have to, as a country and as a society, we have to talk about that. That's not okay. You know, we have to teach young men at a really early age. I mean, their first exposure to pornography is now 8 years old, if you can imagine that. And we have to teach young men and young children that that's not okay, you know, that's just exploitive of of the opposite sex, you know what I'm saying? So, because traditionally, I mean, it happens with boys as well, but traditionally this is impacting young women and women. So, you know, I don't think we do a good enough job, because that is what leads to it. It's that early, it's that early exploitation, that early sort of exposure that leads to this belief that women are for sale, and they're not, you know?
We've had Jamie with your organization on the show several times, and one of the things that we've talked about is, unfortunately, you have preteens or teenage girls even who are living in Fairfield County and, you know, come from families who have money. And sometimes they are some of the biggest targets because you know that they are worth something, which sounds awful.
Right.
But, you know, and what I wanted to, you know, discuss is like, how can we do a better job of protecting people or identifying when human trafficking could be, you know, plausible in a situation? What should we be doing? You know, you talk about that we should be discussing this more and being more comfortable talking about this. How do we do that, especially if you are a parent or a grandparent or a guardian of a young woman in your household?
I think the schools need to take a greater, you know, role, but parents as well. It's just, it's being honest, it's being open, it's knowing who your kids are talking to, which mm-hmm. is a lot. I mean, I understand that that's a lot easier said than done. I mean, I am grateful that my children are older at this point, because the age at which they have these devices is getting younger and younger. And you just, I know how difficult it is to manage that, you know, but it's just, it's our role. We have to protect them. And so know who they're talking to, but it's not who they're talking to, you know, physically, it's who they're talking to virtually.
Mm.
And it's not easy, but we have to do a better job. And I also call upon the tech companies to take a greater role. They're, you know, they are implicated in this. They are profiting from it. It's maddening to me. But they have to have stronger controls, and they have to do a better job of, you know, kind of keeping predators off of their platforms. Because it is so profitable, Melissa. This is such a prop. This is, you know, the fastest growing illegal business in the world. It is going to surpass the drug trafficking industry, because a woman can be sold, a child can be sold multiple times. You know, a gram of cocaine can only be sold once. So, and traffickers understand the profitability, and they're attracted to it, and they're going to go where the money is. And all children are vulnerable, you know, and it's really, you know, they will prey upon insecurity and depression, and that is not socioeconomically, you know, limited. Like, that cuts across all socioeconomic levels, you know, That's who they go. That's who they will target.
Do you think, Elizabeth, with the emergence of tech and social media, that human trafficking is the worst it's ever been? Or do you think with all the buzz around talking about it and at least discussing it in some forum compared to what we did even 20, 30 years ago, it's getting better?
That's a good question, and I don't know that I can answer it, because I think we're just aware of it at so much of a greater level now. I do think it is increasing for sure, because, as I said, it's the fastest growing illegal business.
Mm.
So it's definitely getting worse, but I have so much hope, because I do think that this is something that we can educate around. I mean, I always say, you know, we don't smoke like our parents' generation did. We all wear seatbelts because we were educated. So there's hope, because we can educate, and films like Sound of Freedom are kind of a step in that direction. And I think that if we expose it and we shine a light on it, human beings by nature don't want this. You know, we ended the slave trade because we knew it was a crime against humanity, and we understand that this is a crime against humanity. So at our core level, we don't want this to happen, and we know it shouldn't. But if we don't talk about it, and we don't expose it, and we don't get out there and shine a light on it, people don't know, and they'd rather look away because it is so awful. I mean, it's a hard film to watch.
Yeah.
It really is, because, you know,
Yes,
I did see it. And
it's,
we wrote a response. We did write a response. I don't really even having seen it, I don't even understand the controversy. It's just a movie, you know.
Yeah, I got to be honest
really
with
well
you.
Done.
I haven't really even looked into the controversy. I just heard that it is a hard movie to watch, just because of just the storytelling, but also because at the end of the day, you walk away from movies, and sometimes, you know, like, you go to see a horror film, and you kind of in the back of your mind know that there's like a 99% chance that what you just witnessed in the film will never happen. And while
right.
this may not be 100% accurate, this is what's happening. And I think that's a hard thing to walk away from when you go to a movie and you realize that you just had your, you know, $10 of popcorn and slushy and watched a movie, and there are children and women and men, there are people who are being trafficked as you sit there and watch it. That's a hard reality to swallow, for sure.
Absolutely.
If people wanted to learn more information, the website is PEHT.org. Definitely check out Partnership to End Human Trafficking. And Elizabeth, I thank you and your entire team for what you do here in Connecticut. Please keep it up. And I look forward to having you back on the show, hopefully really soon.
Thank you, Melissa. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Elizabeth Kolnick-Bulbul, again, the founder and president of Partnership to End Human Trafficking here on WICC. Welcoming back to the show, Bridgeport Police Chief Roderick Porter, who is here. Chief Porter, welcome. How are you?
I'm good. How are you this morning, Melissa?
I'm doing fine. I love that we have good news. That's not really heard of too often in today's world, but the Bridgeport Police Department has reported that overall crime statistics throughout the city have been on the decline in comparison to this time last year. I don't want to steal your thunder here, Chief. So why don't you tell us what you guys are finding at the police department and in the city of Bridgeport? Tell us what statistics do we have?
Yeah, Melissa, you know, I'm happy at what we see here. But I just want to preface everything with saying, you know, our statistics are one thing, but how our citizens feel is what's most important. And some of the feedback we've been getting from some of our citizens regarding some of the outreaches that we've done are really positive. So above our crime statistics, how our citizens feel is what's most important to me. But we do see some steadiness as it relates to this time last year. But we do see some really good decreases in terms of our shooting incidents, our non-fatal shooting incidents, as well as our fatal shooting victims. So I'm really pleased at that. So it is positive news for us. And I think, as stated, our community engagement and engaging the community is what's really helping us drive these numbers down, as well as some of our crime initiatives as well.
So looking at some of the specific numbers here, follow me, listeners. The number of shooting incidents has reportedly dropped by almost 34% from this time last year, with non-fatal shooting victims at a 40% decrease and fatal shooting victims at a 33% decrease. Now, of course, one shooting is one too many, so we're not saying that, you know, the problem has completely resolved, but certainly progress is better than nothing at all. Chief Porter, why do you think we're on the decline? What do you think is factoring into that?
I think some of the collaborations that we do with our federal and state partners, we've been really strategic in targeting the right individuals to get the right individuals off the streets. And I think some of the efforts that we've done in that way is really starting to pay dividends. I think that's some of it, as well as our police presence. You know, we're roughly 60 to 70 officers down from this time last year. And we're just trying to be creative in how we deploy our officers. And I think that's helping as well.
I was going to ask that, Chief Porter, and of course, I don't want to give away your secrets, but how are you seeing statistics on the decline? Not to be a Debbie Downer, but just from what would naturally probably happen, I was shocked when I got this email this week, because I know, as you just mentioned, you're down dozens of officers. I know there is an initiative right now in Bridgeport to try and get another 100 officers on the force by next year. How is it possible that statistics could be down when we're down 60 officers? You know, how, you know, when you say you're getting creative, what does that look like?
So I think the most important thing we're doing is, like, we're really engaging everyone in the department. And our officers, they are, you know, the main ones responsible for all of this. My command staff, we come up with strategic ways to deploy our officers. We, you know, we're really particular and where we want to deploy. I think it's the hard work of our officers, you know, being visible, you know, following up on crimes, things like that, as well as I can't stress how important it is the partnerships we have with our federal and state authorities. Some of our task forces, they are really strategic in picking off the right individuals. And I think that's really having a good effect.
And again, we have Bridgeport Police Chief Roderick Porter here. There was an announcement actually via email that the police department is announcing a decrease in crime statistics in Bridgeport compared to where we are this time last year. We are on the decline when it comes to shootings. Now, what about other statistics, Chief Porter, like carjackings, purse thefts? You know, there's a lot of crime out there. What is Bridgeport seeing in other facets of crime?
So as it relates to like felony larcenies, we are slightly ahead, and we're ahead in felony larcenies. So we're just encouraging people to be much more vigilant.
What do you mean ahead? Like we're doing well, or you mean we're ahead of where we were last year?
We're ahead of where we were last year.
Oh, that's not good. Okay.
And those are like thefts that rise to a certain dollar amount that that you know will constitute that they be classified as felonies. It could be items stolen from cars and things like that. Our motor vehicle thefts are up slightly, just 12%. So those are results of individuals leaving their cars running during the winter and things like that. But I just think if everyone's much more vigilant, we could reduce our felony larcenies as well as our motor vehicle thefts.
Chief Porter, I know since you came into this role permanently, one of the things that you've made to be a real point are these weekly, they're like Facebook Live town hall almost meetings, these forums. How do you think that's going after doing it for several months now? Do you feel that that's making a difference? Do you feel like people are being heard?
Yeah, I definitely do. And those are ways that we can share and educate the community on how ways that they could, not be victims of crime and prevent crime. But, I think that, throughout the last several weeks when we've done the parades and we've been out and about walking, many community members have stated they watch us on Facebook Live and they enjoy them. So we've gotten some really positive feedback, and we're going to keep those going. I mean, in this day and age, you have to try and connect with the community as many ways as you can. And that's been one of our most receptive ways.
What about getting engaged with young people? I know that one of I would say one of the biggest messages I get from police at any municipality is public reporting, rather, excuse me, where you are reaching out to police with tips, or you feel you could trust police, even if you are anonymous, with letting them know what you see, what you've heard, getting engaged in community matters. And that could include a crime that's been committed. Do you feel that you've seen more of that kind of interaction from the community? And kind of back to my other question, which is, has the department made it a point to also integrate themselves into like local schools, for example, and get kids comfortable with the police?
Yeah, definitely, Melissa. We've, before the school year ended, we did several roundtable forums where we went into certain schools and we had discussions with kids, some of the students, and we talked about issues that are important to them. And I think that's vitally important. And building those relationships will ultimately help them be comfortable with interacting with us and sharing information with us, as well as our midnight basketball, where we're able to engage with young people. And we also have a boxing program that we support where we're able to do those things. So that is, and we look to do that even more as we go into this new school year. I can't wait to meet with the new school superintendent to discuss ways with her on how we could be integrated and collaborate and meet with students in the school to develop some good partnerships.
All right. And certainly I want to also reiterate that Chief Porter was on the show last week talking about the recruitment efforts that are underway for the city of Bridgeport for their police department. And tomorrow there's going to be another one of the agility exam demonstrations happening in the afternoon. It's going to be at 4:30 over at Harding High School on Bond Street. And we will actually replay some of those details for you tomorrow on the show for people who want to sign up for that. Definitely you should go and check that out. The number, if you want to reserve a spot, 203-576-8332. You could certainly find out more as well on bridgeportct.gov/BPD shift. And Chief Porter, I always appreciate having you on the show. Thank you for giving us the time. And certainly, like I said, some good news is better than no good news at all. And I'm happy to see that at least some of the statistics show a decrease in certain crimes in the city. That's fantastic. All right, Chief Porter.
Out there, And August 1st, we're going to have our award ceremony for National Night Out at 300 Congress Street at 5 o'clock. So please come out and watch these officers be awarded.
I love that. Thank you so much. Again, Chief Porter with the City of Bridgeport here on WICC.
Connecting commerce to your community. Bridgeport Regional Business Council President and CEO Dan Onofrio. Now on Melissa in the Morning. On WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Dan, welcome back to the show. How are you?
I'm good this morning. How are you, Melissa?
I'm doing fine, thank you. One of our top stories this week, the Trumbull Mall deciding to put a curfew in place. And correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, but this is only for Saturday nights, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, just Saturday evening, I believe, after 4 p.m.
Why just Saturday? I know that this is what other malls have done, including the Milford Mall did that earlier this year. Why just Saturdays, especially over the summertime when kids could be at the mall any day of the week, really? They're not in school.
Yeah, I think that's probably the most, I haven't talked to the owner specifically on the strategy behind it, but I believe that it's probably when they're seeing the most traffic. And I also probably assume that they're trying to ease into it, right? It's a tough decision to make, but I think it's an appropriate one that they've decided to do, just to foster an environment where it's safe and family-friendly. You don't want to cut off our teenagers, and because obviously that it's a place for them to congregate and come together, and that's what the mall represents. But I think if they did it every day of the week, I just think it's maybe a little bit unrealistic and maybe unnecessary, really. So I presume that they see the foot traffic, and they probably targeted Saturdays as the time during the week where they're probably seeing the most foot traffic and the most, for lack of a better word, loitering of the teenagers and things of that nature.
So do we think this is a good idea, Dan? And why now? In comparison to why isn't this just like a standard? I know that for Milford, it came after a massive fight broke out there. I know at Trumbull, we've had a couple of instances just this year where there have been people escorted out. A gunshot had gone off at one point. But it's not like we've never seen trouble happen at the mall before.
Yeah, it's a good point. I would say this, I would say that the security and safety at malls, it's not like in the 90s. In the 90s, I remember it was really, really bad. And I think if you really dig into the information and the data, and of course I don't have that in front of me to share with you necessarily, but I don't think, I think the malls generally are safe. They're safe places, right? And then you have these instances where, there's a fight breaks out, or they have the incident not too long ago where the gunshot got mistakenly, erroneously, fired off. So of course it brings it front of mind, and parents, get concerned, right? They don't want to send their kids to the mall, and they're concerned about that. So I think it's appropriate action that they did to just alleviate some of those concerns around safety. We've been doing, I think we spoke briefly about the reuse study of the mall, the future use of the mall, because the malls across the country are changing, right? And, Town of Trumbull's putting an effort in. We've got a consultant that is trying to really identify what the future use of this mall is going to be. And out of all the conversations that we've been having with the community, with business leaders, inevitably, safety is like the number one concern, and whether it's perceived or real, it's needed to be addressed. And I think the owners did the appropriate action by, saying, okay, we're going to address this. We're going to ease into this. We're going to, require that, teenagers under the age of 17 come in with an adult that has to be 21 or older. Otherwise you're going to turn them away. So whether that's good for business or not, I think that is a debate, right? From my perspective, Melissa, the parents are the ones, right? The working folks are the ones that have the money and probably the spending dollars. So teenagers, are looking for a place to stay. They probably spend some money at the food court. How much are they buying and frequenting and patronizing the stores within the mall? I don't know. So the businesses are going to have to adapt a little bit. But I think, in the end, in the long run, it's probably a good thing because, like I said, the mom and dad or the adult that's going in there, they're probably the ones that are making the money, and they're probably the ones that are spending and shopping. And I think by doing this, you're allowing them an opportunity to say, okay, we're going to go to the mall today to do some shopping. and they're going to bring their teenagers and the younger family members to the mall. So I think it would actually help, you know, as a service, it seems like, oh, that's a bad thing for business. But I don't know. I feel like it's an appropriate action. And two, I think ultimately, you know, businesses will, it'll be better for business in the end.
So we're talking to Dan Onofrio of the Bridgeport Regional Business Council. The governor earlier this week, Dan, as I'm sure you know, put a release out encouraging people from the manufacturing industry to register for the Connecticut Manufacturing Ambassador Program, which was a recently launched state initiative to enlist industry advocates called manufacturing ambassadors who are interested in learning about the sector of work and volunteering their time to promote and strengthen the work that is happening here across Connecticut. Now, you and I have talked in depth about manufacturing jobs in Connecticut, and I thought this was a really great, I'm going to call it an excuse, to kind of reiterate some of the opportunities that are out there. And I know that Bridgeport has like a like almost an expo specifically for manufacturing, correct?
Yes, yes. We've been hosting, and our partners that we call the Southwest Connecticut Manufacturing Partnership, last 2 years, we've hosted a career expo dedicated, you know, strictly for our manufacturers. We've had, you know, well over 40 manufacturers this past year, all looking for, you know, to not only educate, and I think that's the big part of this ambassador program, not only educate our community that, hey, manufacturing is a viable career, and there's a lot of different career pathways within manufacturing, but also to give an opportunity to, you know, educate, but also look for talent, too. And I think a lot of our manufacturers have found some success stories within the expo. And you know, we look forward to doing it again next year and continuing to evolve that program.
Dan, tell us if you don't mind, because you and I have, like I said, we've discussed this before, and I want to obviously send people over to the Ambassador Program website after we talk about this. But how has manufacturing, in your professional opinion, how has it changed and grown and yeah, I would say even like just change the image of what people archaically think of manufacturing jobs to be. How has it changed?
Yeah, I think what people don't realize, Melissa, is that, you know, it's no longer an industry that's dark, dingy, and dirty. You know, I think that's probably the best way to describe it. You know, there, technology has played it, and everyone knows technology is changing every day and impacting how we do things and also how we make things. You know, I don't know if I shared it on the show, but, you know, I had cracked a tooth a couple of weeks ago. Actually, it was the week before we had our annual meeting where I had Paul Lavoie, the chief manufacturing officer, as a keynote speaker. So I chipped a tooth, I cracked a tooth, went to the dentist, and they made the crown for my tooth right there. So
really?
Arguably, you know, you and our dentist, yes, with a 3D printer, and it was incredible. And it wasn't a permanent, but it got me through until the permanent came in.
That's awesome.
And people don't think. Yeah, and people don't think that how technology is really changing how we produce and make things, and they're now all dark, dingy, dirty, you know, facilities. We've got some very high-tech industries that you know, our manufacturers are leveraging. You know, they need to get more efficient, more effective. It's not all about machinery and you know, metals and all that stuff. I mean, although that's a big part of our sector here in Bridgeport. So I think, you know, the ambassador program that you're speaking of and the things that we're doing across the state and specifically within our manufacturing partnership in Southwest Connecticut is really to try to educate our parents and most importantly, the students that are going to a technical school or in high school and trying to figure out what's their next step is. And, you know, not all students are cut out for a 4-year institution and they don't realize that, you know, you can produce some really cool things. And there's a very clear career pathway for some of these jobs. So I think that's the, you know, the gap that we're trying to fill right now in the manufacturing space. So, you know, and then couple that with the aging demographic that, you know, they're aging out. There's a lot of these manufacturing businesses, you know, their employee base is they're retiring.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So
yeah.
You got that dynamic coupled with the dynamic of how technology is changing how they produce things. So we really need to sharpen up our saw in terms of educating our youth, our next generation of workforce, to let them know that Connecticut has a very strong manufacturing base and there's some really cool careers within that space right here in Connecticut. So hopefully we can continue down that path. Hopefully we can get our education partners to continue to evolve their curriculum to meet the needs and the demands of our manufacturers that are here in the greater Bridgeport area.
Absolutely. And if you want more information or you want to enroll in the Connecticut Manufacturing Ambassador Program, you can go online to mfgambassador.com. And Dan, thank you so much for coming on and talking about some of these top business stories in our listening area. We appreciate it.
Always, Melissa. Look forward to next week and have a great end of the week here.
Yeah, sounds good. You too. Dan Onofrio, the Bridgeport Regional Business Council president here on WICC.
We've been seeing in the past year how many troubles are happening in the air when it comes to catching a flight. And one of the biggest issues we have seen since 2020 especially are worker shortages. And so we knew that there were issues with different airlines and worker shortages, pilot shortages and flight attendants and all of that. But in recent months, there's been more of a focus on air traffic controller shortages and how that's really been impacting travel a lot. And so joining us now, we have an air travel expert with us. Pamela, I'm going to be honest with you. I do not want to butcher your last name. So I'm going to have you say your last name and of course, welcome you to the show. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks, Melissa. And yes, my last name is Kwiatkowski and I just go by Pamela. So it's all good.
Okay, but Kwiatkowski, did I get that?
You did, Kwiatkowski. Perfect.
Kwiatkowski. All right, I could do that. I can work with that.
Yeah,
thank you so much, Pamela.
Absolutely.
I appreciate you being here. So what's going on specifically with air traffic controllers? Why are we seeing this shift in worker numbers? And what are some of the concerns right now?
Well, we're seeing a shortage simply because a lot were laid off during the pandemic. And then, you know, the training was also halted during the pandemic for reasons of, you know, keeping safe distance. And so it really was a perfect storm. And it's not just the air traffic controller issue. The FFA is working really hard to staff up and train and get the appropriate level of air traffic controllers. And it's a problem that's not just unique to the U.S. It's also in Canada and other areas. But you add that to the airlines and their very tight schedules, and throw in a thunderstorm or two, and you've got a disaster for travelers, for sure.
So I know that there are a lot of factors that go into why we have cancellations or delays, and worker shortage, definitely one of the big issues. Weather, as you mentioned, Pamela. Another one having to do with tech. There seems to be a lot of stories about issues with technology or archaic systems in place that cause outages and things like that. Can you give us any insight into that at all? I mean, it just seems like there are a lot of different factors into why we're having such trouble. There are so many headaches at airports across the country.
Well, I think it's an investment. You know, you're absolutely right. There has been several issues with tech, although they seem to be less frequent as of late in the last few weeks, but certainly early on in the summer. But that, you're absolutely right. It's because they're using old technology. And the pandemic really did put, you know, a sort of a pause on doing enhancements and innovation. And now everyone is trying to catch up, whether it's talent, making sure that we've got staff in the airport, staff on the planes, and also having the technology that, you know, is trying to serve the increased demand for travel, too. You have this pent-up revenge travel. So all of these things accumulated into one have created, you know, havoc for travelers. But there are, you know, I've traveled recently to internationally several times, and there are some tips that travelers can take and apply when they're planning their vacation.
Please feel free to share that with us, because I know we are in the midst of summer vacation, but certainly we're still seeing an influx of people flying where they need to go because they're making up for the years missed, or they just are in the season for wanting to get vacations under their belt. So what are some tips for people to avoid some of those headaches?
Well, first and foremost, try to book an early flight. The sooner you get out, the less chance of havoc happening, right? Things tend to happen late in the afternoon, and then flights get canceled. And so if you have an early morning booking and your flight was delayed, you can get on the next one. So that's number one. Number two, try to book the most direct flight. The more, you know, the more stops that you have, the greater the chance that you're going to have a missed departure or delay. And the other big one is don't check a bag. If you have to be off-boarded a flight to get onto another one, or your flight was delayed and your bags aren't with you, that becomes problematic for you as well. So really pack light, one bag, and of course buy travel insurance, because there are things that could happen to you that could cause you not to be able to make your trip. And you want to protect that investment, because one of the things we're seeing is that travel is becoming increasingly more expensive. These labor shortages, technology, fuel prices, inflation are affecting the airlines, and they need to recoup the costs, and that's going to be, come out of our pocket.
And Pamela, I know that you're an air travel expert, but I was curious if you at all or any of your colleagues could predict if prices are going to start coming down. I'm glad that you mentioned that, because it's pretty astonishing how people are willing to spend the money to travel today, or they have to be, you know, so ahead of the game to try and snag any deal they possibly can with airlines. It is outrageously expensive on average to get on a plane today, even just to fly to Florida from Connecticut. I mean, that used to be just a couple $100. It's now, you know, much more than that.
I don't predict that it's going to come down significantly anytime soon, right? Because you've got demand and you've got supply. You also have, you know, the price of oil. You have inflation, labor inflation. You know, these jobs that are being filled are not being filled at the old, rate that they were paying prior to the COVID pandemic. So we're really looking at a lot of factors that are going to increase price. However, there's always a low-cost airline that comes out to try and grab market share. And, you know, there's always going to be opportunities for those deals.
And what do you suggest with that, Pamela? I'm glad that you brought up kind of, if you will, quote, unquote, cheaper airlines. How reliable are they? Are they getting better? Like, I remember, I feel like when Spirit Airlines was a thing when I was in college, and we're talking, you know, 15 years ago, And that was the way to travel. But, you know, people felt like, oh, like the seats are uncomfortable. There's no room for your legs. They charge you for every little thing. How reliable are these cheaper airlines, or how, you know, would you suggest them to your clients, or do you feel that it's a little more reliable to go with the bigger names, the Deltas, the JetBlues, the Southwests, all those guys?
Well, if you have a very rigid schedule, then you need to go on a major airline. And if you have to get back and you are concerned about flight delays and so on, you want to go on an airline that has multiple flights to the destination that you're going into to returning you home. If you have flexibility and you're a little bit more nomadic, then you can take, you know, these lower cost airlines who don't have frequent routes, right? They may have one flight a day down to Florida or two flights a week down to the Caribbean. So you need to be flexible in your own schedule. So it really depends on your personal needs. If you're traveling for business and you need to get to a meeting and you need to get back to the office, absolutely you need to book an early morning flight on a major airline if you want to make sure that you meet those meetings and you get back.
Well, Pamela, I really appreciate getting your insight. It's certainly something that I know stresses a lot of people out in today's world, is getting to the airport and trying to get on that flight without any kind of major issues in the way. So definitely some great tips for us to keep in mind, and a lot to think about for our next trip. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Melissa. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too. Again, Pamela Kwiatkowski, who is an air travel expert, here to give us a little bit of insight, give us the scoop on what we can do to better protect ourselves, and also to just kind of take some of the stress off when you're headed to the airport, if that's something that's in the near future for you. Some great things you should keep in mind the next time you go.